This show is dedicated to the memory of science news writer Constance Tansey Holden. Hello and welcome to the Science Magazine podcast for April 16th, 2010. I'm Robert Frederick. This week, how the brain is limited to two goals at once: testing and treatment for rare genetic diseases and bringing telescopes to rural Senegal. All this and more, plus a wrap-up of some of the latest science news, including a story about whether we all live inside a wormhole, from our online daily news site, Science Now.
Support for the Science Magazine podcast is provided by AAAS, the American Association for the Advancement of Science, advancing science, engineering, and innovation throughout the world for the benefit of all people. AAAS, the Science Society, at www.aaas.org.
At this moment, you may be multitasking, listening to this show and, say, cooking a meal, or working on a lab experiment, or even swimming. But in a paper in this week's Science, Sylvain Charron and Etienne Quéclin report that if you were to add just one more task, so that you are doing three things at once, your brain just wouldn't be able to handle it. The reason, the researchers say, is that your brain has two hemispheres, a right hemisphere and a left hemisphere, and each side can pursue only one task at a time. So while you may be able to, say, talk on your cell phone, watch television, cook dinner, and look after a child all at once, the research suggests that your brain is only capable of focusing on two tasks concurrently, meaning that for any more, you're actively switching between the tasks or doing them all poorly. I spoke with Quéclin from his office at École Normale Supérieure in Paris and began by asking him what the participants in the study were asked to do.
We presented them letters on a screen, and they just asked to make some pairing of letters. And when subjects were performing two tasks concurrently, one task was to pair uppercase letters, and the other task was concurrently to pair lowercase letters together. And then on the screen appear either lowercase or uppercase, and subject has to keep track of both lowercase and uppercase letters. And that's it. So very simple task, and subject has to switch back and forth between these two tasks, the uppercase letter task and the lowercase letter task. That's it.
And how did you motivate the participants?
So the way we motivated subject is that for each task, they ask reward that they will earn only if they made no errors during a certain number of trials. So it was a monetary reward, actually. So whenever a subject made an error on one of the tasks, the reward was lost.
And how did you measure the participants' motivation?
So we were, during the scanning, subjects were lying down.
fMRI scanning.
Yes.
Functional magnetic resonance imaging.
And we recorded brain activity, and at the same time, we recorded subject errors, reaction times, and so on. So we measure performance, and we found that a larger reward was associated with better performance. And of course, we found brain signature of motivation, that is, especially in this medial prefrontal system, the motivation system, we found that brain activity increased with the level of rewards. And especially within this medial prefrontal region, we found that in the left hemisphere, activation increased as reward value of one task, but not the other. Whereas in the right hemisphere, the brain activations increase with the reward value of the other task.
So when there are two concurrent goals, the brain essentially divides in half, each side, the right side or the left side, right or left hemisphere. And that's driven by each side of the brain's motivational system.
Yeah, the medial prefrontal cortex is the brain motivational system. And in this system, there's a division between the two goals. This system divided between the two goals.
And the whole brain is working on just one task when there's just one task?
Yeah, the two hemispheres cooperate when there is only one task.
But when there are two tasks and two different rewards and you start a second task, does the task with the larger reward always go to one side of the brain or the other?
No. It's as if you have two independent hemispheres. One hemisphere encodes the reward of one task. The other hemisphere encodes the reward of the other task.
So handedness didn't make a difference if the participants were left-handed or right-handed?
So we tested only right-handed because there are many different types of left-handed subjects. So our population of subjects are really right-handed subjects.
So if each of the different sides of the brain is working on its own task, the task with the bigger reward wasn't always associated with one side of the brain or the other. Say a right-handed person uses the left-hand side of his or her brain to control that right hand, and so maybe more adept.
And okay, so the question you raise is how the two tasks distribute between the two hemispheres, which one is located preferentially in the left and which one is in the right. So as I told you, in our subjects, all our subjects were right-handed. It's possible that the on-side influence how the subject will distribute the two tasks between the two hemispheres, okay? The other possibility also is that the distribution of tasks depends about the exact nature of tasks, whether you have more verbal tasks or special tasks and so on, which is not the case in our study. In our study, the two tasks were really identical, which means that the division of labor between the two hemispheres is not primarily related to the nature of the task, but whenever subject has to pursue two goals, two concurrent goals, the two goals need to be distributed over the two hemispheres, between the two hemispheres. But after, there may be additional parameters which influence which task will be located in the left and which task will be located in the right hemisphere.
So what, if any, implications then does this have for human cognitive ability?
So the first implication is that the human prefrontal function seems to be unable to control the execution of more than two goals simultaneously. So it's something which means that in everyday behavior, we can readily switch between two tasks, but not between three tasks.
But it's pretty rare that we're executing exactly the same task concurrently, isn't it?
I'm not sure I get exactly your point.
Why is our inability to do three things at once an implication of this study, which is measuring the ability to do concurrently exactly the same task twice?
So even if the two tasks are similar, the subject need to use two hemispheres, okay? So of course, with three tasks, the division is limited to only two hemispheres, so there is a problem that you have two drives that drive you to execute the task, represented in the same hemisphere, and so there would be huge interference in terms of drive.
Interference in terms of drives, two drives within the same hemisphere.
Yes. So it means that the limitation is not in terms of memory or basic cognitive abilities, to switch between the tasks, but the limitation should be in terms of the inability of your frontal system to maintain the goal, to maintain the drive of doing the three tasks. So you cannot keep track of the three tasks at the same time. But it has also other implications in terms of higher cognition, and especially for reasoning, because reasoning means often to switch in and out, to branch between decision trees. And with this inability to manage more than two goals at the same time, it limits your ability to switch in and out complex decision trees. And of course, it limits, consequently, your ability to make deep reasoning with multiple options and alternatives.
Does this suggest then a reason why we're typically binary decision makers?
Yes.
Choosing between always two things again and again and again?
Of course, it needs further study to really confirm this inference. But we know that subjects have difficulty in deciding between three options. And our study actually provides the possible explanation of why subjects like binary decisions, probably because the frontal function has really a binary nature with the two hemispheres. This is at least what our study suggests.
Etienne Queclin, thank you very much.
You're welcome.
Etienne Queclin of École Normale Supérieure is senior author of a paper on how the human brain seems limited to pursuing only two concurrent goals. Leaders and government officials from 47 countries were in Washington, D.C. this week for a high-level summit on nuclear weapons. Here with more about it is Science Policy Forum editor Brad Weibel.
The aim was to work together to halt the production of nuclear weapons and keep them out of the hands of terrorists. The summit was the largest gathering called by an American president since Franklin D. Roosevelt organized the 1945 meeting that formed the United Nations. The first concrete achievement from the summit occurred when the government of Ukraine pledged to eliminate its stockpile of highly enriched uranium by 2012, the date of the next nuclear summit. Chile and Canada followed with similar assurances. The Bulletin of Atomic Scientists, best known for its doomsday clock, estimates that there are more than 23,000 nuclear weapons worldwide. Underscoring the urgency of the issue, U.S. presidential advisor John Brennan said, "There has been indisputable evidence that dozens of terrorist groups have actively sought some type of weapon of mass effect." The president of the European Council, Herman Van Rompuy, said the European Union will cooperate fully to meet the goal set by the summit of securing all vulnerable nuclear material in 4 years. He noted that the EU is now the major contributor to the Nuclear Security Fund of the International Atomic Energy Agency, with a level of funding which is expected to exceed 30 million euros by the end of 2010. U.S. President Obama had one-on-one meetings with several world leaders, with perhaps the most attention focused on the one with Chinese President Hu Jintao. Among other things, Obama called for tighter sanctions against Iran, which has defiantly defended its nuclear program. Last week, Obama and Russian President Dmitry Medvedev signed a new strategic arms reduction treaty aimed at limiting ballistic missiles. The United States and Russia together have about 90% of the world's stockpile of nukes. The treaty has not yet been ratified by either nation's government. 2 decades after the end of the Cold War, Obama said, "We face a cruel irony of history. The risk of a nuclear confrontation between nations has gone down, but the risk of a nuclear attack has gone up."
That was Policy Forum editor Brad Weibel with a policy update from Science and the AAAS Center for Science, Technology, and Congress. Because of genetic screening, a lot of rare genetic diseases are becoming even rarer. That's because many prospective parents who are at risk for passing on these genetic diseases to their children are taking steps to prevent that from happening. And that's meant that each year, only a handful of new cases of some of these rare genetic diseases occur worldwide. But still, a lot of money is raised through donations granted by science agencies and spent by researchers studying these diseases. As Science's Jennifer Cousin-Frankel reports in this week's issue, that's meant a growing potential to treat some of these previously untreatable diseases, even as these same diseases are being screened away.
This story is looking at an issue that's coming up as we do more and more genetic testing of prospective parents or women who are pregnant, looking for genes behind a number of different diseases, most of them quite rare genetic diseases, but altogether they're maybe not that rare. And more of these tests are being done and will be done in the future. And I was wondering, well, what effect is that having? And what are the goals of this kind of carrier testing, as it's called, to look for people who are carrying disease genes and may, if both parents have them, pass the disease along to their child? And I focused on one disease called familial dysautonomia that seemed like it might reflect what is going to happen over time as we do more and more of this testing, which is make the disease rarer, much rarer. And then I chose to look at what effect that has on all the people who are touched by this disease, whether they're scientists or doctors or families, and what effect this has on them.
So why are these diseases becoming more and more rare?
Well, I think it's pretty simple. They're becoming more rare because we've identified the disease genes in a lot of cases. These are often really very difficult diseases to live with. They're often fatal in childhood. And people want to avoid them if they can. And families who have children with the disease agree that they want to avoid them if they can. So people are being tested for these genes. And what they will do if both parents carry the gene, they have usually a 1 in 4 chance of having a child with the disease. And they have a couple options. They can choose not to have children at all or biological children. They can do a procedure that involves fertilizing embryos outside of the womb and then testing those embryos to see if they're free of disease and implanting only those free of disease, or they can do prenatal testing once the woman is already pregnant and terminate affected pregnancies. So these diseases, not all these diseases, but many of these diseases are likely to become rarer or are already becoming much rarer because of this kind of genetic testing.
Now, you said when both members of the couple had the genetic variant that there was a 1 in 4 chance. What about for the fetuses themselves? How accurate are these genetic tests for them?
Oh, in general, they're pretty accurate. So what's usually done is the parents might be tested first because there would be no need to test the fetus if both parents aren't carrying the gene. So you might test one parent. If one parent carries the gene, then you'll test the other parent. If the other parent also carries the gene and the woman is already pregnant, then the families might opt to do testing on the fetus, to do genetic testing on the fetus to see if the fetus also has the disease. And in general, the testing is very accurate. There are very occasionally lab errors that miss the disease, but they're really, really rare.
And these diseases are ones in which it's pretty certain that if you have this certain genetic variant, then you're going to get this disease?
That's right, yes. These are recessive diseases. Usually it's just one gene that is causing the disease. So genetically speaking, they're pretty simple diseases, very different than adult chronic diseases like cancer or heart disease, where you have a whole lot of genes contributing and the environment is contributing. Here it's just one gene, one disease. One thing to keep in mind, though, is that even with the same exact genetic mutation, patients can still have differences in how severe the disease is. But a lot of these diseases for which testing is done are pretty tough diseases to cope with.
What about the researchers? What's this disappearance of these rare genetic diseases mean for the scientists who are studying them?
Well, I think it's really interesting. One thing that really captured my interest in this story is that this is a really dynamic time right now for rare diseases because we have identified the genes, and that's giving us a lot of insight into how these diseases work and potentially ways to treat them. So it's actually a very active area of research right now. And a lot of people who treat rare diseases generally and research rare diseases become extremely committed to these conditions and spend decades of their life really focused on them and working with the families, and they're just tremendously, tremendously dedicated. So that, combined with the fact that we have a lot of tools now to work in these diseases, sort of creating this interesting dichotomy. On the one hand, there's a lot of potential now to treat diseases that may, until recently, have been largely untreatable. On the other hand, for many of these diseases, there's a shrinking pool of patients who can benefit from those treatments. It's not to say we shouldn't invest in them, but that's just the dichotomy that's out there right now. I would also say a lot of researchers and physicians really get a little concerned by the term disappearing disease. They agree that the disease is maybe becoming less common, but unlike infectious diseases, smallpox that have really disappeared, these diseases, they think, are unlikely to ever completely disappear. That's because we always have a pool of people who are genetic carriers, and so you have to keep testing literally everybody to prevent the disease, and that's just going to be very tough. You know, there's always going to be people who don't get tested, for whom testing isn't available, who choose not to be tested. There will always be very occasional lab errors, so it's unlikely that we'll ever see no new cases of a disease.
Speaking of investing in these diseases, are researchers of these rare genetic diseases still able to get grants from funding agencies like in the U.S., the National Institutes of Health, or are they finding that they have to rely more and more on private donors?
I mean, it's hard to generalize, and it's always been tough for people working in rare diseases, whether they're diseases like these for which there is carrier testing or whether they're just rare diseases that develop for reasons we don't understand. It's always been difficult to get funding for these diseases because they're rare. On the other hand, I think that in some ways, because there are so many new tools out there to study these diseases and because genetics have helped us understand a little bit more about them, in some ways there is maybe a little bit more funding available from the National Institutes of Health. And certainly the disease foundations play a big role in supporting sort of new, maybe more experimental ventures than NIH might support. And then NIH might step in and pick that up. And NIH and other funding agencies also tend to now have offices devoted to rare diseases, and so they're trying to pay a little more attention to this than they did in the past.
So are there any insights that researchers are getting from their work on these rare genetic diseases that might be applied to a broader population?
Yes, I would say I think researchers who study rare diseases have always said that we learn a lot about what's normal by studying what's really abnormal, and rare diseases can really give us insight into both normal physiology and other types of diseases. So, for example, the disease that I looked at, familial dysautonomia, which is also known as FD, there are a lot of interesting questions. One is how emotions and blood pressure are connected. In these patients, their emotional reaction to something that to us might not seem like a very big deal, being excited about something that's coming up or being nervous about taking a test in school, can cause a very massive reaction because their blood pressure really goes out of whack, and that makes them very ill. But some emotions have more of an effect than others. And so asking, you know, why does excitement cause a very strong reaction, but embarrassment cause much less of a reaction? You know, what does that tell us about how emotions are connected to blood pressure, and we don't really know the answer to that, but that's something that in theory, you know, could give us some broader insights beyond FD. But for other diseases, it varies a lot. It depends entirely on the disease, but you could be learning something about, you know, all different systems in the body depending which ones are affected by this particular rare disease.
Jennifer Cousin-Frankel, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Science's Jennifer Cousin-Frankel reports on screening away rare genetic diseases and what that means for the patients who have them and the doctors and scientists who work to treat them. It's been 400 years since Galileo first peered through his telescope, and in celebration of the 400th anniversary, UNESCO and the International Astronomical Union initiated the Year of Astronomy, which was last year, 2009. Several organizations produced thousands of inexpensive telescopes to distribute all over the world, but there are several parts of the world where they are still being distributed, including places where no one has ever seen a telescope before. Earlier this year, science contributing correspondent John Bohannon went to one of those places, rural Senegal, to help distribute telescopes. He writes about it and presents a video of it online in his latest Gonzo Scientist installment. Here's John Bohannon.
I went to Senegal with Katrine Kolenberg, a Belgian astronomer who also does the artwork for the Gonzo Scientist column. And the mission was to distribute 80 telescopes provided by Japan to people in remote villages. And it just seemed like a bizarre enough challenge that I had to record the whole thing.
What was the reaction of people, children and adults in Senegal, when they looked through a telescope for the first time?
Well, it was pretty much universal surprise the first time anyone looks through a telescope. And I don't think that's unique to Africa. I think they reacted the way that kids anywhere would react. I think what was different was that absolutely no one we met had looked through a telescope or even heard of one. You know, people would look through this thing and they would see some distant building. We started by showing them how telescopes work during the daytime, you know, and they would see something far in the distance inside this little black tube. And they all just found it so amazing that it worked. It was like magic. But like anyone, they quickly come to grips with it. They understand how it works. And they even started, especially the kids, would start making jokes with it. For example, when someone else would come up to look through the telescope for the first time, they would sneak a hand in front of the lens to block the incoming light. You know, stuff like that. They absolutely understood how it worked within a minute, even if they didn't understand the physics of optics.
And when the sun went down, what did you have them focus on?
Well, the best thing to look at is always the moon. If you're pointing a telescope at the sky for the first time, there's just so much to see, and it's such a familiar object. You know, this massive, very bright, looming thing, which once you look at it for the first time through a telescope, you realize has a landscape, which is kind of a startling thing. If you've only ever seen it with the naked eye, we just take it for granted as Americans. I know I do. That the moon is a big ball of rock with mountains all over it of a certain size, and people have walked on it. And I just feel kind of jaded about it. I can't help that. But vicariously, it was really exciting to look at it again for the first time through a telescope with these people. And I think the feeling was like when I was a kid, when I first watched Star Wars or any of the great science fiction movies for the first time when I was really young, just this sense of wow. And I think that's the feeling that they had.
Before setting up the telescope, what were the locals' impressions of the moon and other objects in the sky?
Well, for people in the Fouta, which is the region in Senegal where we visited, the moon is first and foremost a useful, practical object. They use it as part of their calendar system. It's the only light at night when you need to go and do stuff. Like, you know, if your animals aren't all in the right place, you often have to count on moonlight for your work. And when people talk about the moon, they always refer to it in the context of this cosmology, which is very different from ours. We got a lot of different stories that feature the moon in one way or another. And I guess the only thing that was perfectly clear to me was that they don't see the moon as a big ball of rock. That was the one constant. I wish that we had one clear story. We got clear stories about other astronomical objects, but the only thing that was clear was that they saw the moon as a big feature of the night sky that is connected to many different stories, but we never heard anyone make any specific claims about what the moon is or what it's made of.
Did those impressions change with your visit? Everyone in this part of Senegal now thinks it's a big ball of rock?
Absolutely not. No, I think our visit was just a drop in the bucket of many outside influences. I think we generated a lot of goodwill. That's really all Katrine's work. She's just an excellent science ambassador. But I think the heavy lifting, if we did any, was on the kids. They just loved meeting Katrine and, you know, seeing what she does with telescopes. And more than one kid was inspired to pursue science to some extent. Now, what the options are for that is unclear. There are in Bumba, the main village where we had as our headquarters, does have a really good school. And that's changed over the past 15 years in the time that Katrine has visited. It used to have no electricity at all. And now it's all wired up. People have televisions. It has a very good school with very dedicated teachers. And we left a lot of telescopes there. And we're in direct contact with the teachers out there. So I think that's probably the place where people's worldview will change. Not in the outlying villages. I think we were like a traveling magic show for them, which is fine. There's nothing wrong with that. I think it was a good thing. But it was definitely an equal exchange. You know, we were magic to them, and they were magic to us.
So it's not as if you're presenting this curiosity to them was in any way similar to Galileo's original reception when he challenged the teachings of the church.
I couldn't help but wonder whether we would run into any tension. Maybe we would be perceived as challenging the powers that be somehow, but the reality couldn't be more different than Galileo's reception 400 years ago. We were really just treated as honored guests dropping in and wanting to have conversations. And people just love to talk out there in the Futa about anything. And if it happens to be about the stars, all the better.
John Bohannon, thank you very much.
Thanks, Rob.
Science contributing correspondent John Bohannon on taking telescopes to rural Senegal. You can find Bohannon's full written and video report online at www.sciencemag.org/SCIEXT/gonzoscientist. Also, in this week's issue, Bohannon writes about one of the organizations that builds the telescopes. Now, courtesy of the Johannes Kepler Project, here's an excerpt of the Astro Capella song Shoulders of Giants, composed by Patty Boyd and performed by the Chromatics.
It was a calm and cloudless night, but it was all still a blur. The shaking of our universe was just about to occur. It was summertime, 1609, when Galileo used his telescope for the very first time, and he saw mountains and craters on the moon, and a Milky Way with thousands of stars, and he saw Jupiter with four tiny moons. He was the only man on Earth that night who knew that Copernicus was right. Come outside with me tonight, and I can show you wonders of the world to surprise and delight. I've got my telescope with me. Just wait until you see that on the shoulders of giants we'll see beyond.
Finally today, David Grimm, editor of Science's online daily news site, Science Now, is here with a wrap-up of some of the latest science news, including a story about whether we all live inside a wormhole. Some new physics theory here, Dave?
Well, Rob, I wouldn't go as far as a theory, but at least it's a hypothesis. And this is how the hypothesis goes. A long time ago, in a universe much larger than our own, a giant star collapsed. And when this star collapsed, the implosion crammed so much mass and energy together that it created a wormhole that opened up a porthole to another universe. And between these two universes, our own universe came to be.
So an alternative for the Big Bang.
Well, exactly. That's actually one of the reasons the researcher in question proposed this pretty fantastic hypothesis. Because as much as we all love the Big Bang theory, it has some problems. One of the problems is the theory of gravity. It turns out there are some problems with gravity. What researchers ultimately would like to do is unify all of the fundamental forces in the universe, and that includes gravity and what's called the nuclear forces and electromagnetism, into one grand unified theory. And they can do that with the other forces, but they can't for some reason do it with gravity. And one of the ways they try to unify all these forces is trace them all back to the very origins of our universe. This event, sometimes called the singularity, that happened 13.7 billion years ago, where there was nothing, and then all of a sudden there was a rapid expansion of our universe. And no matter how far they go back, they can't unify gravity with these other forces. The other problem with our universe, if you will, is the problem of dark energy. And dark energy is this mysterious force that's been hypothesized to explain why our universe keeps on expanding at an accelerating rate when gravity should actually slow this expansion or reverse it. As much as we like the Big Bang and as much as we like our universe, there are some things that we just can't quite square away yet.
So how does this wormhole hypothesis account for these things?
Well, the wormhole hypothesis actually solves both of those problems. First, it solves the problem of gravity by saying, hey, there was an event that happened even before the Big Bang, which was there was already another universe in existence. And this universe, for all intents and purposes, spawned our own universe. And when this researcher did his calculations, he found that now he was able to theoretically trace all these forces. When you trace all these forces to an event even before the Big Bang, theoretically, they may come to a point where they can all be unified in some sort of grand theory. And the wormhole hypothesis also solves this problem of the universe's expansion. Because if you can imagine, and you actually can see a picture of this on the site, if our universe is actually trapped between two other universes and it's in the middle of a wormhole, it's actually being stretched by these universes at both ends. And this stretching could account for the expansion that we see in our universe without having to resort to something mysterious called dark energy.
How is this being received by the greater physics community?
Well, people are pretty skeptical, as you can imagine. I mean, this is all really more of a thought experiment than anything else. Even though the researcher has some calculations, he says his calculations are fairly preliminary. This is published research, so it has, you know, been accepted into a scientific journal. But some researchers say, you know, this is complete baloney, you know, we shouldn't even be thinking about stuff like this. It's completely ridiculous. But other researchers say, even if it is ridiculous, A, that doesn't mean it's not true. And B, it helps us think about, it's always useful to, you know, sort of propose these hypotheses because they sort of allow cosmologists and physicists to do some out-of-the-box thinking, because clearly we haven't been able to solve all the questions that we have right now with the theories we have in front of us.
Okay. So what other stories have you brought with you this week?
Well, Rob, from trying to figure out the mysteries of the universe to trying to figure out the mystery of racism, this next study is all about why people stereotype based on race.
Something about how we perceive people who look different than us?
Exactly. I mean, the question is, why do we, even if it's on an unconscious level, tend to stereotype people? Is it because we fear people who don't look like us or belong to social groups that are different from our social groups? Is it something that's just learned? Is it something that's innate? A lot of questions revolving around why racism persists in society.
So what did these researchers do?
These researchers attacked the question from a really interesting angle. They said, you know, if racism actually stems from our fear of other social groups, can we design an experiment that shows that that's actually the case? And what they did was they actually turned to children who have a very interesting genetic condition known as Williams syndrome. And this condition leads to mental retardation, but children who have it are also intensely social. In fact, one of the researchers talks about walking into a room with 50 kids with Williams syndrome, and they just run up to her and start hugging her and being very affectionate, even though they don't know her.
So no fear of strangers.
No fear of strangers. And the researcher said in this study, if we have these kids that don't have a fear of strangers, meaning they don't have this fear of other groups, might they also not have racial prejudice? And what they did was they gave these kids and a bunch of control kids a standard test that tests things like racial prejudice and even gender prejudice. There would be examples where they would show the children, say, a drawing of two boys, and one would have dark skin and one would have light skin. And the researchers say, now, one of these boys did something naughty. Which one do you think it was? Or they would show the children a picture of a boy and a girl, and they would say, which one of these do you think works at a gas station after school?
For a gender stereotype.
Exactly. And what the researchers found is that the control group tended to have a pretty strong racial bias. And then about 83% of their responses, and these were all white children that were taking this test, they tended to say that the darker skinned individual was the one who had done something naughty. But with the kids with the Williams syndrome, they only had that response about 64% of the time. So they were much closer to almost an even split between not making a distinction between a light-skinned individual and a dark-skinned individual. But the researchers didn't see that same difference when they looked at gender. Both the groups scored about more than 90% in saying that the boy was more likely to work at a gas station, which, you know, fulfills our sort of gender stereotypes about what kind of jobs boys would have versus what kind of jobs girls would have, or what type of jobs men would have and what type of jobs women would have. And what the researchers conclude from this is they're saying, you know, because of the difference that was shown with the racial stereotyping, that it does appear that it's this fear of strangers that really feeds into our attitudes about race. But this same process doesn't seem to work for our attitudes about gender. And that may mean that the stereotypes we form based on gender may actually have more to do with other cognitive processes, such as social learning.
But is it really fear that led to these stereotypes? Do you automatically assume that someone that you're afraid of is the person who's acting badly?
Well, one of the critiques an expert makes of this study is she says that it's not clear whether the kids with Williams syndrome actually are not afraid of these other races because they have so many other disabilities. They may actually have a disability in learning. So if racial prejudice is something we learn from our parents, and the kids with Williams syndrome aren't able to, say, learn this from their parents, then they would also be expected to have a very similar response on the test. And in that case, racial prejudice would be chalked up to social learning rather than a fear of outsiders. So the study isn't totally conclusive on that point.
Okay. So, Dave, for this last one, I see that you've brought a sound file with you. What is that sound?
Well, Rob, listen to this.
What is that?
That, I'm afraid to tell you, is a caterpillar scraping its butt on a leaf.
Is it that loud? I've never heard a caterpillar make a sound that loud before.
Well, Rob, in this case, the microphone is actually pretty close to the caterpillar's behind, but this is actually a very audible sound. In fact, the researcher that first picked up on the sound was rearing caterpillars in her dining room and walked into her room one day and actually heard this noise. And she said, "What is this about?" So she started studying these caterpillars, and the caterpillar you're actually hearing belongs to a group of caterpillars from the hook-tipped moth family of caterpillars. And these caterpillars have what's called, and I'm sorry to gross you out again, an anal oar. And this is sort of a hair-like structure on the rear end that allows them to scrape leaves and make this noise.
Why are they making this noise? Have researchers figured out the reason for this behavior?
They think that the caterpillars are making this noise to scare off intruders. Caterpillars have a pretty soft body and they don't like to get into fights because even the slightest nip can cause them to literally bleed to death. And so caterpillars have evolved the strategy of trying to warn off. So if another caterpillar gets on its leaf and this caterpillar wants to defend its territory, a lot safer to warn this caterpillar off by scraping your butt and making these loud sounds than engaging in an actual fight.
Here it is again.
And you can actually see a really cool video of this on the site. One of the things that's really interesting here, actually, is how the researchers think this butt-scraping behavior evolved. This anal oar actually almost looks a little bit like a proto-leg. So the researchers think, based on studies of some of the ancestors of this caterpillar and other caterpillars that are related to it, that this anal oar may have actually been, at first, may have been an appendage that evolved to help the caterpillar maybe walk, but over time it developed into this appendage that just helped it make noise. So it's a weird case, the researchers say, of where talking may have evolved from walking.
But this isn't talking.
Well,
it's communication.
It's communication. It's a way of saying, "Back off my leaf."
Okay. Well, thanks, Dave.
Thanks, Rob.
So what other stories are you looking into for Science Now or on the policy blog, Science Insider?
Well, Rob, for Science Now, we've got a story about a new mechanism for how cancer cells may metastasize and how that may lead to treatments to block tumor progression, and also a story about how water formed in our early solar system. And for Science Insider, Science's policy blog, we've got a very controversial story about how a federal advisory committee omitted two surveys that were supposed to gauge Americans' knowledge on evolution and astronomy, specifically the Big Bang, which we were talking about earlier, and why these particular questions were omitted from a National Science Foundation report. Also a story about the benefits of biotech crops for farmers. So be sure to check out all these stories on the site.
David Grimm is the editor of Science Now, the online daily news site of science. You can check out the latest science news, plus all the stories from the science policy blog, Science Insider, at news.sciencemag.org.
Support for the Science Magazine podcast is provided by AAAS, the Science Society, at www.aaas.org.
And that wraps up the April 16, 2010 Science Magazine podcast. If you have any comments or suggestions for the show, please write us at sciencepodcast@aaas.org. The show is a production of Science Magazine. Jeffrey Cook composed the music, and I'm Robert Frederick. On behalf of Science Magazine and its publisher, AAAS, the Science Society, thanks for joining us.